One of the other significances about Jesus performing this at a wedding is that, of course, we look later at passages that would refer to Jesus as the bridegroom. And if Jesus is the bridegroom, if he's the groom, then who's the bride? The bride is the church. And so there's a relationship between the bride and the groom. There's a relationship between Christ and the church. And so here at this wedding, what has Jesus done is he's transformed water into wine for the benefit then of the bride, that this is a gift that is given there. Except later, the more profound gift that we would see as we look at the Last Supper, we see that moment at which Jesus, the bridegroom, nourishes the church, his bride, by shedding his blood, and that we have as the perpetual remembrance of that Last Supper, as a perpetual institution, we have the changing of wine then into the blood of Christ, and that we have in the Eucharist. So all of these things, we see water into blood, we see water into wine, we see wine into blood at the Last Supper. Does that kind of complete the triangle there a little bit? Well, there are connections between all of those things. And we see some more things about blood and water as we look at the next passage in John 19. This is a passage that especially anyone familiar with the devotion to Divine Mercy is very familiar with, is that Jesus is on the cross. He has expired. And as they're preparing to take the bodies down from the cross, this is in this passage, this is John 19, and I'm looking here at verse 34. But one of the soldiers pierced his side with a spear, and at once there came out blood and water. And there were many, and it's interesting that John then continues to explain this. He says, he who saw it has borne witness. His testimony is true, and he knows that he tells the truth, that you may believe. For these things have taken place so that the scriptures might be fulfilled. He goes on to make a point of that, to say this has been from an eyewitness whose testimony is true. And I might also couple this with the next passage from the first letter of John. 1 John chapter 5, verses 6 through 8. That next passage that's here. This is he who came by water and blood, Jesus Christ. Not with water only, but with water and blood. And the Spirit is the witness, because the Spirit is truth. There are three witnesses, the Spirit, the water, and the blood. And so here we have the pouring forth of blood and water from the side of Christ. Now, that passage that's here we have water, we have wine, we have blood, these different things that we've been talking about in all of these passages. From the early times of the church, the fathers of the church have looked at the water and the blood as a sign of two sacraments in particular, that were a gift to the church, pouring forth from the side of Christ, given to the church as a particular gift. The water is a sign of baptism, and the blood a sign of the Eucharist. So that's, although the Gospel of John doesn't make explicit, it talks about the importance of it. This has happened, this is true, we testify to this. From the fathers of the church, that's one of the ways in which they take that passage and move forward from it. One of the significances of the water and the blood, baptism and Eucharist, gifts that are given. And then in the first letter of John, we talk about this as being a testimony. One of the things, we could go back to the very beginning of Genesis. How is it that Eve was created? From the rib of Adam. So what did God have to do to Adam? He put him into a deep sleep, and then he opened up his side. That's what the passage says. So he opened up his side so that the rib could come forth, and then from that, then God took the rib and then fashioned the woman Eve. Well, it's kind of a funny way of putting that in the beginning of Genesis, but there's a connection then to Jesus Christ, because what had happened at the time his side was opened, he had already expired, and so you can call that the sleep of death. There are times at which in the scriptures they say so-and-so has fallen asleep. But sometimes when they say that, it can also be a metaphor for death. So instead of being cast into a deep sleep, this is Jesus who had actually passed. He had expired. And then what happened? His side was opened up. And from his side came forth that which was for the church. So we can say that the church was born. This is a great theological expression of the church, that the church was born from the side of Christ as his side was pierced on the cross. So that coming forth of the water and the blood is for the nourishment, the sacramental nourishment of the church, by which we are refreshed and by which we are fed and nourished from the water and the blood. And so we see that passage there. Revelation chapter 11. This is an interesting passage. It takes a little bit of time to explain. I'm going to kind of gloss over a little bit of the background of what's happening at this moment in the book of Revelation. But there's a time at which a judgment is being visited upon the people. Various plagues have been sent upon the earth, and people have either reformed or not reformed. And at this point, there are different people who are rebelling against the Lord. So the Lord sends these two witnesses. Now, these witnesses are a mysterious way of depicting them, because we're not given any names of the two witnesses. We're only told certain things that these two witnesses who have come to preach to the people who have rebelled, who have not repented, these two witnesses come to preach to them. They are as two olive trees and as two lampstands. Here are these two witnesses. Again, we have that flame of faith that is presented there. And we're told that they can do certain things. Verse 6, they have the power to shut up the sky so that no rain may fall. And they have the power to turn water into blood. Who turned water into blood? Moses. Okay. Who shut up the sky so that way no rain may fall? The great prophet Elijah. And so you have Moses and Elijah, I think, symbolically presented in the description that you have here in Revelation 11. Who were the two people that appeared next to Jesus at the transfiguration? Remember, Jesus was transfigured in glory, and then on either side were Moses and Elijah. Again, Moses and Elijah. What did Jesus come to fulfill? What two great Old Testament institutions? He has come to fulfill the law and the prophets. Okay. Who represents the law? Moses. Who's the greatest of the prophets, or the archetypical prophet Elijah? So you have a sense in Moses and Elijah that they represent the fulfillment of they represent the law and the prophets. Jesus is the one who fulfills that. He is the new Moses. He is the new Elijah, the one to complete that work that was begun. I mention this just because in this passage, as the one of these great witnesses has the power to turn water into blood, it's another reference back to the scene in Exodus that we have there, that part of what this is this represents the law and the prophets, the law and the prophets that were gifts to the world, that proclaim God and his plan of salvation and his great mercy, eventually that make demands of the people as they follow the law and as they heed the commands of the prophets. And eventually what happens, and this is where you have some of these very mystical terms that are there. What do the people do when they receive the law and the prophets, or this testimony? They kill the two witnesses, and then they gloat over the fact that they've killed them, but you can't silence those two great witnesses. They are raised up, and then they take their place in the heavens. So they went up to heaven in a cloud. So it's a very mystical passage, but just another little reference to the importance of that changing of water into blood. Of all the things you could describe about to indicate Moses or to indicate the law, it's interesting that that's the image that was chosen, that idea of that transformation from one thing into the other. As we've been mentioning, as this is the scriptural study of the Mass, we're always looking back to the Mass and to the Eucharist. So the primary reference then for this type of transformation is what we're looking to in the Eucharist, the changing of wine into blood. So we see all these different images, Old Testament passages, New Testament references to these things that talk about this kind of transformation. Something that is really impossible except by God's grace, to change one thing into something entirely new, something entirely different. But that's exactly what we believe happens in the Eucharist. A transformation of one thing entirely into another. There's one difference, though. Let me take the time to do this, because this is important. How do you know that water has turned into blood? How did they know that that happened in the time of Moses? Because they could see it. Okay, they could detect that. And what happened as soon as the water turned into blood? It said in Exodus, it says that then all the fish began to die. So you have a direct consequence that's there. How do you know that water is changed into wine? In the wedding feast of Cana, the stewards drew out, they put the water in, they drew it out, they didn't know yet. They hadn't figured it out. They took it to the head waiter in charge who tasted, and so he could tell. So there are ways in which you can sense, you can tell because of your senses, because what you see, what you observe, what you taste, you can tell that there's a difference. How do you know that wine has turned into blood at Mass? By faith. Because there is no way to sensibly, meaning by use of your senses, determine that a change has taken place. What we're talking about is a complete change of one substance into another substance, and yet at the same time, it has all the appearances of the former. It still tastes and appears, for all intents and purposes, to still be wine, even though we believe it has gone through a complete transformation. That's one thing unique about the Eucharist. Different from all these other things is you can't detect the change. You can't detect the change through the use of your senses. Interesting, isn't it? Okay. Do you know the tantum ergo that we use it at exposition or at benediction? When we get to that part, tantum ergo sacramentum veneremur cernui, et antiquum documentum, novocedat ritui, praestet fides supplementum, sensuum defectui. That's praestet fides supplementum. That section there talks about the supplement of faith, fides supplementum, the idea that faith supplying, faith needing to supply, sensuum defectui for our senses, which are defective. Our senses are unable to grasp something that faith must supplement. So that passage, fides supplementum, sensuum defectui, is talking about the fact that our senses are incapable of detecting something that faith must supply for, that faith must make up for. And that's exactly what we're talking about in the Eucharist. The inability of us to detect by sense, but which we must detect by faith, the presence of the Lord. Okay. There. Those are a couple of sides that were not in this passage. Maybe I should put the tantum ergo into the passage there at that point. So you see that part. But it's a great expression by Thomas Aquinas of that matter by faith. So then we come to Exodus 12, the Passover ritual. This is a long passage, but a very, very pivotal passage. In some ways, we might say that this is the key passage with respect to the Mass. I think I can probably say that. There are a couple other passages that are pretty significant as well, but this is one of them that has so many direct connections to what happened in the New Testament at the Last Supper, and so many direct connections to things we do in the Mass here. As the Passover gives this to us, and certain things that are symbolic connections we have that remain with us in the Mass today.